feel now? How do we feel after the meditation? Spacious. Feel okay?
Calm.
Better? Good?
Slightly
restless? So different feelings, all just feelings. Different experiences, all just experiences. And they're all good, as long as you don't have a reaction to them. Thinking, I want to feel different, or I don't want to feel like this, or I want this to last. Everything's okay if we're okay with it. So I thought, having been invited here tonight, that I thought I should honour your commitment to engaging, being here on a Friday night. It's pretty special. There's probably other places you could be. Being other places, doing other things. So why be here? What's the thing about being here in a university room where you've probably spent a lot of the hours of the week, a lot of hours of the month, a lot of hours of the years. You want to be here on a Friday night? So why are we here? Any ideas? To learn. Did you forget something? Any other reasons?
To relax.
Anything else? Could it be what you're drinking? That's just water. It doesn't look like water. Maybe the thing is it's a special tea on a Friday night at the Buddhist meditation group. Is there anyone that's here for no reason at all? Anyone in the wrong room? So we all have our reasons, and most of what we do is motivated to engage some particular activity, exercise, pursuit for some particular reason. And most of the reasons that we have can be summarized in one main reason. One main reason why we're here. So, yes, different individual reasons, and there's maybe some crossover. Yes, I'm here to learn something as well. Yes, I'm not here to be happy. Yes, I'm here for whatever. But the one main reason that we're all here, the one main reason that human beings engage and pursue most things is to be happy. So it's been said for thousands of years by sages, saints, philosophers, and certainly now by psychologists and scientists, that more than anything else, human beings seek to be happy. More than anything else, human beings seek to be happy. Is that true? Certainly, we say generally speaking, most of what we do is for the pursuit of an experience that we call happiness, either in the moment if I eat this, if I drink this, if I look at this, if I experience this, it's going to give me some form of happiness, or the consideration, if I do this, then in time it will bring about an experience of happiness. And for most people, spending time at university, yes, it's, you know, it can be pleasant, it has its pleasant moments, but unless you really love universities, love the life here, love the buildings, love the people, and want to become an academic and pretty much live here, most people only use universities for the pursuit of knowledge, learning to enable a certain career, to be able to have a certain income, to be able to afford to live in a certain place, to be able to buy certain things and certain entertainments and so forth that brings the happiness that one may otherwise be after. So it's a commitment to more of a happiness down the track, and maybe even years down the track. But still, it's that pursuit of a particular experience. For example, if we're thinking that, in 5 years' time, I'd like to become a Buddhist monk or nun for the rest of my life. Well, why be at university then? Probably, you know, it's not much point, unless it's maybe you're doing Buddhist studies. But because the Buddhist monk and nun gives up most of the things that people do seek happiness from, whether it's being able to choose your own food, wear what you want, entertainments, maybe alcohol, maybe intimate relationships and so forth. Buddhist monks and nuns give up that for their own form of happiness. So there's still a seeking of happiness, but obviously a little bit different from the happiness that people might be seeking through careers and everything that may provide. But I think it's really important to consider, reflect upon one's intentions behind engaging in a particular pursuit, especially if it takes time and energy, and to check in, will this particular endeavour, engagement, pursuit bring about what I'm really wanting, or not. Just as a matter of interest, what sort of studies are yourselves doing? Science?
Commerce?
Fine arts? Engineering? Anything else? Nothing else?
Architecture.
I'm waiting to hear somebody saying they're studying psychology. Anyone? No one studying psychology. They found happiness. They don't need to study psychology. Anyone studying medicine? Psychiatry? I always like to check if there's any psychology students or psychologists in the room, just in case I have to sort of be careful what I say. But I think this topic of happiness is something which certainly of recent, in the last few years, has become a topic of interest for people. There's even institutes now that look at happiness institute, and books that come out about happiness, as there have been for a long time, but really focusing a bit more on, you know, what happiness is, and how to enable that, how to experience it, and what real happiness is. But I think that what's really helpful is to appreciate that most of us are really seeking some form of happiness. And happiness, it's a pretty loaded word, like love is. It needs some definition, because there's a lot that happiness encompasses as a psycho-emotional, psycho-physical state that human beings are seeking. But I think that one can do well to reference what the Buddha said about happiness. And I certainly see the Buddha as a, in terms of a historical figure, a great, certainly a great teacher, but in many ways a great psychologist. A great psychologist, a great physician, a great philosopher, a great sociologist, a great psychotherapist, where he looked into his own mind, both before enlightenment, after enlightenment, and really sourced the ultimate experience of happiness, and then spent the next 45 years teaching others how to realize that for themselves. So after realizing Buddhahood, and I think that as more and more people in contemporary culture, contemporary society, become interested in real happiness, and also in the mind, in meditation, in mindfulness meditation, they're also inclining towards an interest in Buddhism as well. And, so in a way, you know, yourselves being here tonight, it's wonderful to see many people that are willing to give up what other people might be doing on a Friday night, their particular pursuit of happiness. Past those on the road here, various sorts of clubs and pubs and bars, people seeking their happiness. But to realize that maybe there is something to what the Buddha has said that we can apply and realize 2,500 years after he gave his particular diagnosis, prognosis and prescription for practice, for realizing ultimate happiness. And so he spoke about three levels of happiness, the three main levels of happiness. And the first level, which is the lowest level, is the happiness where most people get stuck. Most people get stuck on the low level of happiness. And this primarily is happiness through the senses. So through the body, and also we can include in that to some degree the mind, the thinking mind as well. And it's an area most people get stuck, because you can get fast happiness through the body. So whether it's through looking at something that's, you know, interesting, exciting, beautiful, whether it's smelling something, tasting something, that's a big one, tasting, eating. Or whether it's through physical sensation, even the intimacy of sexual engagement, a very strong physical form of seeking happiness. All these forms of happiness may be more particularly termed pleasure, so sensory pleasure. And whilst they're all valid, and whilst it's, you know, part and parcel of being alive as a human being, and certainly we deserve to have some pleasure through the senses, because there's plenty of sensory experience which isn't particularly pleasant that one has to deal with. So yeah, why not? Why not have some pleasure through the senses? However, we can even add thinking to this as well. There's some pleasant thoughts. Think about something pleasant, pleasing, wonderful, exciting, exhilarating, etc. Problem is that the pleasure through the senses and through the faculty of thinking, it doesn't last. It doesn't last. Certainly relates to the Buddha's fundamental teaching of sambeha sankhara anicca, all things are impermanent, including especially the fleeting pleasant experience that comes through the body and thinking mind. It's impermanent or doesn't last because of a number of things. Firstly, the experience itself, in terms of the object of sensory experience, it doesn't last. So if you really love the tea, who made the tea tonight? Who made the tea? No one made the tea. It's reused from last week. So even as good as it is, it doesn't last. The thermos, whatever it's in, it's finished, or it's finished in the cup. So it doesn't last. You can't drink endless tea. Well, you can't. And so the first thing is, it doesn't last. So whether it's a cup of tea, whether it's a Tim Tam, piece of chocolate, whether it's a lovely, lovely meal, a movie, whether it's some moments of intimacy with someone else, they don't last. The sensory experience doesn't last. First reason, bad investment. Second reason is the apparatus for experiencing it doesn't last. So this has to do with aging or illness. So for example, as the body gets older, then its ability to experience sensory perception gets less. A few people wearing glasses in the room. You might have been wearing them all your life, or not, but it just means that the faculty of seeing, the eyes, maybe aren't so perfect. So we need an extra lens to be able to see things. In time, probably, let's say in, most of you might be in your 20s, so probably within 40 years' time, probably most people will be wearing glasses. Might be a few hearing aids as well. And as well, the tactile experience isn't so comfortable because there might be aches and pains and a bit of arthritis here and there, and the body's not so comfortable. It starts to get a bit creaky and uncomfortable. More unpleasant sensation than pleasant sensation from the body. Let alone the fact that these bodies are built with an element of uncertainty as to how long they'll last, and also the experience of illness or disease. So one doesn't have to have an old body, an old spacesuit, to have it not function well. Sometimes these bodies come out of the factory with faults. So the ears don't work so well, the eyes don't work so well, or no taste, no smell, whatever. So even at a really new age, they have faults, built-in faults. Hospital up the road can maybe help some of those things out. But basically, again, problematic. The third main reason that sensory experience for the body, for pleasure, for happiness, may be not such a good idea, is that the senses are only sensitive to change. Interesting, our senses are only sensitive to change. So after a while, the senses get used to the particular experience. So, for example, you might, if you're outside, you might come in the room and go, oh, it's a bit warmer here. After about 5 minutes, you don't even notice the temperature. Or you might come in and notice, oh, it smells a certain way in this room, but after a while, you don't even notice it. The senses acclimatise, they get used to it. If the sensory experience changes and we notice, oh, it suddenly changed, but they get saturated, they acclimatise, and then we don't notice, which is why often with sensory experience people have to up the ante, up the experience, a bit more sugar, a bit more caffeine, another piece of chocolate, please, have another piece of whatever, just to get that extra sort of buzz of pleasure that would otherwise have had at a lower level. So again, problems. And certainly even with thinking, which isn't so much a physiological sensory experience, even though it's based upon the physiology of the body and the brain, but that's not perfect as well. You know, even to think, well, I just want to have pleasant, lovely, wonderful, beautiful thoughts all the time. And even if you wanted that, would that be possible? You might have to do that. Keep meditating. Not possible. Which goes to show how much we really own our own mind. How much the self thinks of mind, really own our own mind. Because the mind is can be overcome with very unpleasant, distressing thoughts. So if we're just after pleasant thoughts, they it can't be done as an ongoing, enduring, sustainable experience. Or even just to consider, well, at least I'll just have pleasant thoughts for half an hour. Not an hour, just half an hour, please. No, just within 24 hours, I just like to have a half an hour block of pleasant thoughts. Does it work? No, because thoughts are only last a short amount of time, maybe just a few moments. Do it again. So challenging. Let alone the cost of sensory experience, the cost of things that we would like to have to give us that pleasant experience. The cost is going up. You've got to work to be able to have the money to buy those pleasant things, and so forth. So challenging. So for human beings, you know, it's a difficult lot if we expect, want, hope to be fulfilled in terms of happiness on that lower level. Again, bad investment. But the good news is that the Buddha has recommended other higher levels, other higher forms of happiness that are possible for us. But again, it comes through knowledge and understanding and appreciating that to experience a higher form of happiness that maybe has better quality, maybe a bit more sustainable, less affected, less afflicted by the problems on the lower level, then we'll have to maybe let go of the lower level happiness to be able to experience the higher. So the second level, or mid-level happiness, is happiness which is not so much determined by the body, let's say, by being able to see well, hear well, smell well, taste well, feel well, think well. It's more to do with the quality of the mind-heart. The Buddhist word citta, mind-heart, heart-mind. And here this is a happiness that, again, not so much born of the senses, but born of the mind-heart experiencing wholesome states of mind, states of heart, virtues, what are often called the paramita, psychological, psycho-emotional, psycho-spiritual values, virtues, qualities that we all have to some degree that give a sense of pleasure, a deeper, more refined pleasure. Such as the experience of compassion, kindness, joy, gratefulness, appreciation, delight, equanimity, the experience of a calm mind through meditation. So more of a refined form of happiness. But to experience this, one needs to let go of the lower form to be able to engage and develop and experience the higher form. And I expect that maybe the reason you're here tonight is not so much because of the pleasure of the tea or the biscuits, but more that second level. Like, I feel good. Good feeling through being here, being with like-minded people, friends, connecting, listening to some spiritual teachings to nourish the mind-heart, possibility of creating wholesome karma, generating merit. It's going to be supportive of one's well-being, a sense of joy in that, a sense of appreciation of your potential in that. And then tomorrow morning, you wake up and feel, yes, I feel good for having gone to the Unibuds group last night. I feel good. I didn't get drunk out of my brain in the pub. Feel bad. I feel good. A sense of warmth of heart, warmth of spirit. A sense of good energy and good karma. And it is really helpful to acknowledge the worth of one's wholesome engagements. A sense of taking that to heart, feeling good in that, because that becomes motivation for being here again next week, etc. A sense of delight, a sense of joy in that. But the thing is that the happiness doesn't just remain there. There is, it was a happiness that is higher than just engaging in wholesome qualities and values and virtues. This is a special form of happiness. A happiness which the Buddha 2,500 years ago has directed people's minds towards. It's a happiness that is not dependent on things, on senses, on the body, not dependent upon anyone, anything. So in that way, it becomes a special form of happiness. And in this, we could use the Buddhist word, which is generally used for happiness, the Buddhist word sukha. Where the word sukha? So from the ancient Indian language of early Buddhism, Pali, sukha, where sukha is the opposite of dukkha. Dukkha is, again, a word which describes unease, stress, dissatisfaction, disappointment, suffering. So the possibility of sukha, which is more than just a sensory pleasure. It's more of a more refined experience. And in this context, the Buddha spoke about ultimate happiness as the experience of sukha. It's interesting, the Pali words of Theravada Buddhism, ancient Indian language, the word ka means a type of connection, to connect, to fit together. So su as a prefix is like a good connection, a good fit. Du means like a bad connection. So dukkha is like, if this doesn't fit, this doesn't work, it doesn't connect, it's not right. But the sukha is the right connection, sort of aligned. And I've written on the board here a statement of the Buddha, which says, sankhara paramadukkha. Sankhara paramadukkha. Nibbānaṁ paramaṁ sukhaṁ. It's worth remembering. It's worth remembering. Easy with those two words, dukkha and sukha, sukhaṁ. Also sankhara and also nibbāna, nibbānaṁ. The word karma or paramaṁ. So the word parama means, let me ask you, what word in English is similar to parama? Paramount? Yes. So paramount, which means great, great, big, paramount in movie pictures. It is paramount that you do this, it's really important. So we have sankhara, which means phenomena, things, creation, sometimes used for thinking. Sankhara, thinking, creation, things are greatly, dukkha, greatly unsatisfactory, greatly unsatisfying. So all things are greatly unsatisfying. Then we have nibbanang, paramang, sukhang. So nibbana, from nibbana, nibbana, enlightenment, freedom, the unconditioned is the greatest happiness. The greatest happiness. Nibbana is the greatest happiness. So how could you want for anything less? Anyone want a lesser happiness? Remember, bad investment. Not going to last. You're going to be disappointed. So this is where the Buddha has pointed out that if you want to be happy, then go for the ultimate happiness, the happiness which is the happiness of Nibbana. And don't think, oh, well that's not for me, I'm just a student. I'll leave that for the Buddhist monks and nuns. Not necessarily. If you have a mind, then you have the possibility of realizing Nibbana. It's just that Buddhist monks and nuns are people like ourselves. I was a Buddhist monk for many years. They're just people like ourselves that wear a particular uniform and find it helpful to practice spiritual teachings in a context set up for that. It's a bit like universities are environments set up to facilitate learning, but you don't need a university to learn and to study, especially these days. A lot of texts are online, and you can read all the texts you need, and you can go to lectures here and there, not as a university student, but it's helpful. It is helpful, maybe easier to do it as a university student. But the point is to appreciate that we don't have to be a Buddhist monk or nun to practice the Buddhist teachings and to realize the Buddhist teachings and to realize them in this lifetime as a possibility. And especially to be motivated towards this. Maybe this is the real meaning of being. Are we here being born as a human being just to be born, grow up, study, and then get a job and work, get married, work, have some kids, work, holiday, work. And then retire, daytime television. retirement village, and die. Is that the meaning of your life? Is that what you want? Because that's what it is for most people, unless they have meaning beyond that. Sure, we still need to get educated, have a job, family if you want, work and so forth, but we don't make that the ultimate meaning of being. There's something more to being alive, and that maybe, I'm just putting out here as a maybe, an invitation to realize your freedom, realize ultimate freedom, realize ultimate happiness as a possibility. Doesn't mean, again, that you have to spend a whole lot of time meditating on retreats and so forth. It's more about understanding the way in which the mind works. And this is where, in a way, we can all become somewhat pseudo-psychologists. So, if I come here next year, I'll say, who's studying psychology? We're all pseudo-psychologists. We're all interested in Buddhism. We're studying the Buddhist teaching. It's a psychology of the human condition, where it's a psychotherapy for healing the mind out of the basic ills. Yes, we're all psychotherapists as well. John, you're in good company. So, that as an appreciation. And what's really, really important is to appreciate that the mind that we have here is only limited by the faculty of thinking. The faculty of thinking limits sets up parameters, sets up boundaries, sets up restrictions, sets up contraction, and limits the ultimate freedom that is otherwise already the case. You might wonder, what does he mean by this? Well, it relates to even the Buddha's eightfold path, right, called the eight-factor practice path for conscious living, which begins with samadhi, right view, having a clear right view on things, which then leads into right thought, and especially the right use of thought, the right skillful use of thought. Anyone bring any knives here tonight? Any knives in the room? No? No one bought a knife? But knives are very helpful and useful, aren't they? Have we ever eaten without the use of a knife at some time? Maybe you use a spoon or some chopsticks, but or a Thai spoon. I, for many years, ate with just a Thai spoon or even my hands. That was my aunt's fault. But that food had been cut up with a knife. Knives are really helpful. In the evolution of the human species, knives have been very, very important. And probably you've got knives where you live. Yeah? Probably more than one knife. And not just because you like knives, because they're useful. But we didn't bring any here tonight, did we? I'm not asking out of security. Just using it as a analogy. So knives are really helpful. They've been helpful for human beings for thousands and thousands of years. But also knives are very dangerous. They can kill people. They can kill people. They can kill animals. They can slash property. If you don't use a knife properly, you can cut yourself. But the knife is neither good or bad. It just is. It's how it's used that's important. So do we know how to use a knife? So if we know that the knives are at home, whereabouts are they at home? In the kitchen, not in the bathroom. And in the kitchen, in the fridge? No, not in the fridge. So whereabouts are they at home? Under the sink. In the microwave? So they're probably in the knife drawer. They're in the knife drawer, they're placed in there, we know where they are. And if we were to need a knife, we know what we would use it for. And when we pick up the knife, we pick it up by the blade. Yes? No? By the handle. And will we have the blade pointing up towards us when we pick it up to use it? And the blade pointing down. And so, okay, we hold the knife correctly, we use the knife to cut up what we need, then we wash it up and put it back in the drawer. We know how to use a knife. So thinking is the same. Thinking is as good as a knife. Very, very important, very helpful. But the problem is most people haven't learned how to use thinking correctly. So they think when they shouldn't. They think about things which they shouldn't think about. They think maybe wrong time, wrong place, the wrong degree. They pick up thinking and they can't put it down. It's a bit like going and having a shower with your knife in your hand. Who thinks when they're in the shower? Maybe thinking when you're on the toilet. Maybe thinking when you're eating. Maybe thinking when your friend is talking to you. Maybe thinking when you're supposed to be listening to a lecture. Maybe thinking when you go to sleep. Maybe thinking in your sleep. Maybe thinking when you wake up in the morning. This is the wrong use of thought. Hence the Buddha prescribing, hey, the right use of thought. Because thinking, it's neither good or bad, it just is. It's a tool to use to help us, help the human being survive and do well. But problem is, most people have not learned how to think well. Now, when do I use thinking? What do I use it for? How do I engage it? For how long then putting it down? Because thinking gets in the way and becomes a problem, like having a knife. It's a bit like going to say hello to somebody with your knife. Hello. like going to say hello to somebody and you're thinking about them or about someone else, and sort of your mind isn't there to connect. So miscommunication, misconnection occurs. Relationships become problematic because people are just thinking too much. So meditation is very, very helpful for training the mind not to think so much, because thinking can be dangerous. Certainly in the profession that I do, a lot of people's issues that cause so much pain and distress, you know, real pain and distress, real emotional suffering, whether it's anxiety, whether it's depression, whether it's trauma, whether it's all types of emotional distress and confusion, not because they've got a sore toe, it's because they're thinking too much, thinking in the wrong way. The thoughts get out of hand, they become obsessed, overwhelmed, even to the point of becoming addicted to thinking. Isn't that crazy, to be addicted to thinking? So if we set up an experiment now, please do not think for the next 10 seconds, no thoughts. Can you have no thought? Anyone thinking? Definition of an addiction, anything that you cannot control. Something which you have the inability to do without, apart from breathing. So, in many ways, we are addicted to thinking. We find it very difficult to stop. And, you know, we sit in meditation. I'm going to sit here and just be aware of my breath. I don't need to think about breathing to breathe. But it's difficult because the mind was, oh, tonight I'm doing this after the group. And, oh, what's happening tomorrow, the weekend? I've got to go there. I've got to study. Or, what happened last weekend? Thinking is there. So it becomes important to appreciate that this wonderful faculty, ability that we do have, it's important to learn how to use it correctly for our happiness and well-being, because often what limits our happiness and well-being is the misuse of thinking. And this is by degree, even up to ultimately. So whether it's about having a lovely meal and that someone might have prepared for you, you're sitting there and you're thinking about exams, and so that you're not really being there to smell and to taste and to savour and to experience it, so you miss out on even that physical pleasure. Missed out. Someone says, how was the food? And, oh, yeah, it was good. Did you like it? Oh, well, I guess so. And, oh, didn't quite taste it. Maybe I'll have another serving, please. So maybe get it this time. So, you know, thinking gets in the way. Or even right up to, again, this experience of, or realization of, nirvana, enlightenment. And what gets in the way is the thinking that creates the cloud, that we could say, the cloud, which is the phenomena of self. So what limits the mind from ultimate freedom is the misperception and the misuse and the misunderstanding of the phenomena we call self. So we all have a sense of self. Everyone has a sense of self, yeah? And have you had a sense of self all your life? Well, there's one year that... We generally have a sense of self all the time, or so it seems. But in fact, the sense of self, is only happening in particular moments, not all the time, not 24/7. Certainly a lot less when one is asleep, unless you're dreaming. But then also in waking hours as well, we're not always operating from senses of I'm doing this, I'm thinking this, I'm sitting here. We're not always operating from what I call reference point self. But the mind joins the dots the moment, 3 moments later, another moment, 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 joins a dot, which creates the illusion of me being continuous. I'm here, I've always been here, I'm always myself, that's who I am. But that is the illusion. But in fact, it's just moments, 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 moments of sense of self. But for the purpose of a continuity of self, the mind creates that illusion. But there's not in real time those many moments, seconds, minutes, hours of continual awareness of self. So for example, when you're really listening, there maybe isn't a sense of self, there is just the listening. When there maybe is walking, maybe you're not thinking, I am walking, I'm walking, I'm walking, I'm walking, I'm walking, there's just the walking. Not that the mind is off elsewhere, thinking of something else, but there's just awareness. Just awareness. So the self, in fact, is what I call a neurologically based psychological phenomena used to interface experience, especially for interpersonal interactions. So it's a neurologically based, a brain based, neurologically based psychological phenomena used to interface experience, and when and where appropriate, especially for interpersonal interactions. Basically, it's a communication tool. It's a mobile phone. Self is a mobile phone, in a way. But whilst we probably all have mobile phones, anyone doesn't have a mobile phone? No one doesn't have a mobile phone. I got my first mobile phone a couple of years ago. My secretary gave it to me. It was her old one. Hardly use this. But everyone has a mobile phone. But the problem is, it's about learning how to use the mobile phone correctly and not have it dominate your life. Because that becomes a very real thing, that the mobile phone can dominate your life. I can't leave home without my mobile phone. I've got to have it with me. I don't know where it is. It can't be outside of a meter of my body. I've got to have my mobile phone. I've got to maybe hold it. I'm okay with holding it. And maybe it's just to see who's contacting me. Excuse me. I have clients that come and see me. Sometimes I have two mobile phones. They come and they sit down and I'll just take stuff out of the pockets. They their mobile phone and two mobile phones and do you mind if I leave my mobile phone on just in case someone needs to contact me? Okay, that's what you want. And we're sitting counselling, sort of looking over just to that's sad. But and we can laugh, but it's becoming more and more the case. People can't do without their mobile phone. It's part of their security. It's part of how they interface reality. I know who I am through my mobile phone. In terms of my mobile phone is an expression of who I am. In terms of the type of mobile phone that I have and the apps that I've got. You got the latest app on. The ringtone. Maybe your screensaver on your mobile phone. Photographs you've got on it. This is who I am. You want to know me? Know my mobile phone. So, but it's an apparatus. It's just an electronic apparatus that's used, and hopefully to help the mind-body organism get by. But it can become such that it takes over, so that people again live through their mobile phones, they live for their mobile phone, they work hard to be able to get the latest, newer mobile phone. You know that you've seen the queues of people sleeping outdoors the Apple shops waiting to get the latest mobile phone that comes out, Apple. And I use the mobile phone as an analogy because it's like the self. The self was only meant to be an apparatus for communication, just to be used now and then, when needed. But it's taken over. It's taken over, and so that you think that you are yourself. Yet the self is this mind-made phenomena that is just occurring through thinking in the brain, and it is a result. It's a result of the particular thoughts that your mind chooses to engage. And some people choose the wrong thoughts based upon conditioning from often their early childhood. In psychological terms, it's called a schema or a mindset. So that your parents say, I think you're bright, you can study at UNSW, but your sister, don't even think about it. Your sister might be bright, but she's got told that she's not. And so she goes, I'm not bright, that's who I am. I'm not bright, that's who I am. I'll have to go to Wollongong University. Or not. So the particular thoughts create the sense of self. And this is where psychologists become helpful, because psychologists see that people's sense of self, which is the source of suffering, self causes suffering, that sense of self can be modified, because it's not a permanent, ongoing, enduring thing. It's a bit like reprogramming the mobile phone. That app is really annoying. Let's get rid of it. That ringtone doesn't work. I sleep through it. Or I don't hear anymore. Change it. So in the same way that with a sense of self, it can be modified. And psychology helps people to modify their sense of self, so they have a better functioning sense of self for interfacing with experience. And whilst people can spend time, even years, in seeing psychologists, psychiatrists, psychotherapists, it still is really only dealing with the mobile phone, not dealing with the real possibility of happiness, which is behind, beyond the mobile phone, beyond the self. And this is where the Buddhist teaching comes in, to appreciate the possibility that real ultimate happiness is the mind freed from thinking, freed from the misuse of thinking, freed from the limitations of self, freed from the ignorance around self. Because self is a limiting factor. This is who I am, I can be that and not that. Self becomes this interface to experience, and self, which for the most part tends to seek pleasure, not enlightenment, because the self seeks pleasure through body experience, I like this, I want that, or through thinking, what I like to think. But the experience of ultimate happiness is the mind, which is unconditioned, unconditional, free from self, or at least free from the ignorance of self, where the self is just used as a helpful tool to communicate to other minds when and where appropriate, as is the mobile phone. So meditation becomes an opportunity to take a break from the self, take a break from yourself, to put down the persona and just be, being the knowing. Not being someone sitting here doing meditation, just being the knowing. Not even being the knower, that creates a position. I am the knower, I am the witness, I am the observer, it's me. It's the self again. But more like the faculty of knowing. Knowing awareness, which is behind the self. And even language-wise, self, sense of self, or ego self, personhood, personality, person from the Greek word persona, which means Anyone know what persona means? Persona.
You mean the Greek word, or
the Greek word, yeah. No psychologist in the room. Persona means mask. And so in Greek drama, the persona is the mask that the actors would wear in the drama. And interestingly, we have that same word, so in English, for person. You're a person. Actually, you're a mask. And why are you a mask? Because a mask needs to hide or be the interface for that which maybe is beyond a face. So pure conscious awareness has no face. And pure conscious awareness has no face. So to relate to another pure conscious awareness needs to be the mask. Now we know who we are, now we can relate. Latin for persona, so ancient language of Latin, per, which means for, we even use that in English, no? Per, this, which means for, and sona, as in sonic sound, for the voice of. A persona, for the voice of. So the mask or self is for the voice of. For the voice of that which is beyond or behind, which is pure, conscious, knowing awareness, unconditioned, unconditional, already free. And so this is where freedom, nirvana, Sanskrit nirvana, which as a term isn't something, it's denoting the blowing out, the eradication. So nirvana means extinction, extinguishing of illusion, the extinguishing of the illusions, the extinguishing of that ignorance of self. And what is left is ultimate freedom, ultimate peace, ultimate happiness. Hence nirvana paramang sukham. Anything created, conditioned, the sankhara, is greatly unsatisfactory, unsatisfying, dukkha. Sankara paramadukkha, nibbanan paramang sukham. So that's those two lines point the direction towards the ultimate happiness, which is available and possible to us if we simply let go of thinking that the mask is who and what we are. Breaking that illusion, breaking that delusion, breaking that confusion, breaking that conflict, which creates all the separation. This is me, that's you. What are you doing there? How did you get that? How can I get one, two? How can I get a bigger one? Faster one. Red one, I'll get two. I'll get a younger one. All that stress that self, the limiting factor self creates. And so I think that for us here now, living in the 21st century, we are challenged individually, globally, as a species, and as a planet as well, as this planet is really challenged ecologically, environmentally, which will then flow on to social problems because of self. The source of all suffering is self. Body experiences pain, but it's the self that creates the suffering. I don't want to, I don't like it, how can I get another one of those? I'm unhappy, I'm jealous, I'm confused, I'm distressed, I'm depressed, I'm afraid. Self. Mind made, thought made. And so seeking, well, I'll be happy if I eat that, if I buy that, if I go there, if I get one of those, if I get rid of that. Again, a bigger one, a faster one, a young one, red one, get two, get four, get more. I'll be happy. But for how long? It doesn't last. And yes, it drives the wheels of commerce. Buy more, eat more, drink more. Commerce. But ultimately, people don't get satisfied. They don't get happy. They just get depressed and anxious. Come and see me. I give them this pep talk. Get real. You want real happiness? Don't look out there. Look within. All the energy, all the time that goes into trying to get happy out there. If you spend that time, energy, looking within and practicing some basic psycho-spiritual teachings, the Buddha's teachings, maybe you'd realize that ultimate happiness. And maybe stop consuming so much. And maybe the planet would be in a better shape as well. How generous. How kind to say, well, hey, I don't need to have more. I can be happy with less. But I know that more will never fulfill me. Because more will never fulfill self. Self can't be fulfilled. It's just mind made. It's just a whole collection of thoughts. So this is a possibility. And what will save us as a species, what will save us as a society of biological organisms living on this planet is wisdom. So not more of greed, anger, ignorance, not more self, not more selfing, not more egocentrism, but real wisdom and the real happiness, the experience of real happiness, that is the possibility. And so I think what's necessary is a revolution. Now we've done the big experiment in psychology. We do experiments and come up with a hypothesis. If human beings try and get more of what they don't have, push away what they don't want, then we suppose they'll be happy. And human beings are pretty intelligent creatures. We think we're the most intelligent on the planet. Maybe we are, but with this we seem to have gone off on the wrong track, because the idea of being happy, you think that, since, as I began this presentation, most people most of the time do seek to be happy in the various issues which they engage, you think that by now the human species, over the last several thousands of years, happiness, want to be happy, pursue happiness, happiness, happiness. I think that by now, 21st century, that most people, most of the time, would be happy. I think we would have got it right by now. Simple thing, that's happiness. But most people, most of the time, would be happy. Have we achieved that? What's gone wrong? Something's gone wrong with that particular endeavor. So we want to put a human being on the moon. We've done it. We want to put human beings under the ocean. We've done it. We want to put human beings down in the earth. We've done it. All sorts of stuff. Science, great. But happiness? Have we achieved ultimate happiness for most people? No. So we need to actually look at, well, what's gone wrong? Maybe we've got stuck on that lower level happiness which can't ultimately fulfill. And so again, it's like people like the Buddha who've realized ultimate happiness and freedom. Go, what did they say? What did they do? If I do want to be happy, not just now and then, but all the time, what do I need to do to realize that? So that's going to help us individually and as a collective and as a species and also the planet as well, because our lives, the lives of future generations, your children, your grandchildren, depend upon that. They depend upon that. I have varieties of different clients, and many of them are intellectual people, scientists, philosophers, people who work in business and so forth, and people are recognizing the fact that our planet is in a challenged state, and that global warming, climate change, which then it only needs to change the temperature of the planet slightly for mosquitoes that otherwise would die in the cold season to not die, and therefore spread infections, which will move into new areas of population, increasing things like malaria and other diseases, and also the deforestation and problems with lack of rain, then lack of transpiration, and also flooding and earthquakes and landslides, and then people moving across borders because they their lands are being washed away, or that the land has died because the plant and animal life, and then border conflicts and starvation and crime and all that sort of stuff. So I think it's up to people like ourselves, as intelligent human beings, to be able to bring about a new paradigm of possibilities in terms of fulfilling happiness for human beings in the various ways, whether it's through science, whether it's through psychology, whether it's through politics, education. So it's it's a really important time in human history, because the quickening is happening such that things are developing and advancing at a fast rate, and gets quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker. So think about that for yourselves, in terms of maybe how you live your life, what you give meaning to in your life, and also just even that point of realizing ultimate happiness. Don't settle for less. Don't settle for a lesser form, because you're not going to find ultimate happiness there. Go for the highest form of happiness, the unconditional happiness of freedom as a possibility. So I offer that to you for some reflections. Hopefully we'll keep you going for another year. Any thoughts or comments? Complaints? Driving of evolution, especially for the human being, is that I'm not happy in an old building, I'll create a new building. Here we are. I'm not happy with an old mobile phone, I want a new one, I'll design one. So that certainly moves progress and even evolution as well, so that even just the physical body is evolving over time, and it will quicken as well. So I think that probably in not too long a time we'll find that human beings have eyes closer together, and they'll have fingers such that you can operate texting really quickly. Just even more pointed fingers, because generally these fingers are built for tool holding, for smashing, and not for texting really. So, and also I think that the ear will grow closer to the mouth, because it doesn't have to, but it will, because mobile phone makers want to increase their profits for the shareholders, of course, so they create smaller mobile phones, less plastic, and therefore to hear better you actually have to have your ear close to your mouth. And before, the mobile phone used to be this long, easy, a mobile phone this long, and it was easy sort of speak and listen at the same time. The moment sort of moving or sort of got a yell at it. So we are physiologically evolving, and certainly neurologically as well, our brains are evolving as well. I find that technology is often driving that in terms of how the brain is growing and functioning, so that children these days have abilities that their parents don't have. They also have disabilities that their parents don't have. because of the technology and the cognitive neurological influence of things that they're engaging. But I think to that point that maybe because people are becoming more dissatisfied, I've got everything and I'm not happy. That's a lot of clients like that, but really, really sort of wealthy people. I have a practice in the eastern suburbs of Darling Point. I have a practice in North Sydney. I see people from two very affluent areas of Sydney, and they're not happy. I say, well, I'm the managing director, I'm the CFO, I'm the CEO of this company, I'm on many boards, and yes, it's my Bentley at the front there. Now I've just come back from a holiday in the Caribbean, but I'm really not unhappy. I'm really anxious and depressed and distressed. My wife doesn't like me anymore. My kids don't even know me. I'm not happy. I can buy whatever I want, but I'm bored. So it's sad. It's really sad. But that maybe drives people to go, okay, well, what else? What else could there be? Maybe happiness isn't about things, it's about non-things. Hence the growing interest in Buddhism.
Do you ever recommend anything other than meditation? Do you ever recommend meditation?
Yes. As a psychologist, I don't prescribe medication. But for some people, for various reasons, they would not find benefit in meditation unless they had medication. Because they may be too anxious, too depressed, and so the medication helps to balance out the biochemical imbalance, so they're able to be stable enough to study, go to work, function, meditate. But then maybe over time, they can reduce the amount of medication, especially through practicing meditation, as a possibility. Example, I was speaking along these lines just before coming here. I saw a client, and he was saying, "Oh, John, I haven't been surfing, big wave surfing, for some time, but I went surfing just recently, and being in the ocean, being in the water, the waves were huge." And he said he had just a feeling of letting go of his role as a scientist, and also studying philosophy. balanced bloke. He said, I was in the water and I just let go of being who I was, and there was just a sense of harmony and oneness and wholeness, being totally present. And so relating that to that experience of not self, just being the knowing. And we may have experienced this ourselves. Language is a problem because we always use personal pronouns, language, you know, in terms of we experience ourselves. But it's more like there was the experience of that present moment knowing, which can be experienced as a moment of being in the zone, or what's called a flow. So a moment of flow where there is no self, there is just the knowing engagement of what's happening. And often in those occasions, the person is functioning at a much higher level than otherwise. Because often when self is there, the person becomes self-conscious. Am I doing this okay? Got to keep it going. What do they think of me? What's for dinner tonight? And they lose that edge. But in a experience of flow or being in the zone, there's just a mindfulness, and self is not necessary. Self is that limiting factor which neurologically consumes a lot of energy of the brain and then causes a lack of dexterity in the body. So for example, a surgeon, if he's doing a very intricate job, has to let go of self-concern, self-esteem issues, just be totally in the moment, on the job. People often experience this in areas of performance, whether they're an athlete and they have to let go of everything that they got told about how to perform, and just let it go. They're just there. It's their game, even though there may be others around them, maybe running, and they're just in the moment, and the gun goes off, and there is the running. Not, I'm running, how am I doing? Oh my goodness. They are the running. Or in performing musically, where there's a sense of letting go of, oh, here I am performing, but I think I'm alright. There's just the flow, the music, the happening. And so they are moments that are akin to that experience of being the knowing being, the not self. The five hindrances, do you know what they are? Yes. So the first one is often the wanting or the sense desires. But all of these hinder the natural clarity and purity of the mind. So they hinder or they get in the way. Not just in meditation, but also in regular life as well, so that you're listening to a lecture and you start thinking about having a sausage roll. or whatever. The lecturer's causing you to get frustrated because you're not speaking loud enough, or you were up meditating all night and so you're feeling a bit dull and drowsy, or that double caffeine shot with extra sugar is sort of making you sort of agitated, or you're doubting that you're going to even do well in the exams. So they can come up in any time, not just in meditation, but they're always motivated and revolve around self. So it's only self that goes into I'm wanting this, or I don't like that, or I'm really bored, so I'm just going to go into dullness, or into I feel unease and I'm feeling restless, agitated, or I doubt myself. It's always an only self. So in a way they become a good looking to say, there is the hindrance, and it's the manifestation of self, and then be able to disengage the mind from that. In Buddhist psychology, they can be seen as sort of a tendency or a trait. So different people will have different hindrances that are more strong or dominant. So you could have someone that's a bit more of a desire, sensual desire sort of person. Another sort of person is more always irritable and irritated and sort of a bit sort of angry and negative. Someone else might be more of a sort of bit of dull dimwit. Someone else a bit more of a sort of hot-headed, always agitated, that you can't slow them down. They'll never meditate. What for? You know, if I need to do something, got to do something, got to do something. Someone else is always sort of unsure. Am I doing the right thing? What do they think about me? And self-doubting. So they actually become personality traits that people tend to have more of one than another. But it's good to be aware of them because they hinder your performance even just on a self level. They get in the way of you performing better as yourself, and also they are the manifestation of self. So they actually hinder the natural peace, purity, clarity. clarity, stability of the mind. Does that sort of answer the question?
So at work, let's say if you happen to have a very pushy boss, and you want to sort of focus on doing your task at your own pace, but then he keeps trying you more and more work, and then keeps pushing you to work faster and faster. Then in such scenario, then how would you still be able to maintain your own pace by being yourself instead of being controlled by your boss?
Get another job. Difficult.
Well, try to focus, but try to focus, well, try to keep focus, but it's just difficult to keep distracting me.
Yeah.
But certainly more.
Maybe to see, well, can you actually do the job as quickly as he wants? Maybe you can in time if you get faster and faster at it, and then maybe it's about saying to him, hey, I appreciate you want this done really quickly, I'm still learning, I'm still getting used to it, and I think I can pick up the pace, but I'll maybe need to be able to focus and not be distracted, and be really helpful for me and for you and for us if we're able to, if you allow me to get on with the job, and I'll try and measure my pace and keep it going and develop over the next few weeks.
But the problem is that there is a certain tendency that the more productive you are, the faster you work, then the more work you get into someone.
That's right. So don't work too fast. So maybe one has to begin really slowly. Really slow. Yes. So thinking generally includes mental words in the mind and or mental images. As opposed to awareness, can be thought free. So just thought free awareness without any words, as in like I can be looking at the wall and I can see the colour of the wall without actually thinking, oh, it's a mustard coloured wall. Reminds me of some hot English mustard I've got in the fridge. But just a visual experience, acknowledging as pure awareness. But thinking often comes in wanting to describe or compare or remember, and that's what adds on to just the basic experience. And also, again, it takes extra energy and often leads the mind off elsewhere. So it can actually be a real practice just to be able to focus on just keeping things with the bare attention, the bare knowing of the sensory experience without having to make comment or commentary about what's happening. To some degree there may be the thought, I am aware, but then that in itself can be a distraction. And as a bit of a technique, what you can do to disengage from the personal pronouns, the sense of thinking I, me, mine, and even to use thought in a way that doesn't engage self. So for example, if you're listening, rather than going, I'm listening, but to say in your mind, there is listening. That's free from any personal constructs. There is listening. Nothing needs to be added to that. If we go, I am listening, then it's like, am I listening well? My mother said I listened well. Not my brother, though. He's good at other things. He can run fast. Not like my dad. I wonder if where he gets it from. Maybe my mother runs fast. And the mind just flickers off. So there is listening. or if you're walking, rather than thinking, I'm walking mindfully, I'm walking, there is walking. Or there is, rather than I'm breathing, because I'm meditating, and I'm breathing, and I'm mindful, there is meditating, there is breathing, there is mindfulness. So it takes away the personalizing of experience as more open and more peaceful. It's a good thing to try it as a practice. So any last questions or comments? One else for complaints. One more, last one. Where is the mind? Well, I would say it depends upon who you're asking. You're asking a neuropsychologist or a regular psychologist. Or if you're asking a philosopher, or if you're asking the Buddha, or different answer. And also depends on what sort of answer you want. So it's one of those questions that which could be answered by, it all depends. It all depends. And especially depends upon the definition. Because there's certainly neurological definitions to the mind, and there's also psychological definitions of the mind, also spiritual definitions of the mind. That really depends on where you're asking from and how you're going to use the answer as well. But it's a good question. Maybe it's worth pondering. Well, thank you for listening. Thank you for the invitation to share Friday evening with you. I wish you well with your endeavors, especially with your study or your work, your relationships with your life, and hope that what we have considered tonight has been helpful. So thank you.